Welcome to the Federal Society's Practice Group podcast. The following podcast, hosted by the Federal Society's Litigation and Federalism and Separation of Powers Practice Groups, was recorded on Friday, June 22, 2018, during a live Courthouse Steps telephone conference call held exclusively for Federalist Society members.
Welcome to the Federalist Society's telephone conference call. This afternoon, we will discuss the recent Supreme Court decision in Lucia v. SEC. My name is Laura Flint. I'm the Deputy Director of Practice Groups here at the Federalist Society. As always, please note that all expressions of opinion are those of the experts on today's call. Today, we are happy to have with us Mark Chenoweth, Executive Director and General Counsel at the New Civil Liberties Alliance, and Dr. John C. Eastman, Henry Salvatore Professor of Law at Chapman Law School and Senior Fellow at the Claremont Institute. After hearing from our speakers, we'll go to audience question and answer. Thank you for sitting with us, Professor Eastman. The floor is yours.
Thanks very much, and thanks to the Federal Society for organizing this discussion and all of the discussions they do on the courthouse steps. It's an important time of year at the Supreme Court as Supreme Court watchers wait anxiously at 10 a.m. every Monday and now Wednesday and Thursday and Friday mornings waiting for cases to be decided. This one kind of has a narrow application in its particular ruling, but very broad implications, and we're going to talk about that. The case is Lucia versus Securities Exchange Commission, or Lucia. I'm a little bit more Italian, so I may say Lucia on occasion. I don't quite know how Mr. Lucia pronounces it himself. But the issue was whether the appointment of administrative law judges in the Securities and Exchange Commission was constitutional. Mr. Lucia was charged with various securities violations. His case gets before this administrative law judge, and he challenges the constitutionality of the appointment. A little background before we get to his particular challenge, and that is, you know, looking at the text of the Constitution itself. Article 2, Section 2 gives to the president the power to make appointments by and with the advice and consent of the Senate of all officers of the United States. Now, principal officers, that's the only route available to appoint principal officers. So your cabinet secretaries, your heads of major agencies, judges, Supreme Court justices, I said judges, that's an open question, Supreme Court justices all have to be appointed, nominated by the president, and then only appointed after the advice and consent of the Senate signs off on the nomination or gives them the confirmation. But the Constitution sets out an alternative mechanism that can be utilized if Congress by law says so, and that is for inferior officers, those are kind of the next layer down. Congress can, by the statute that creates those inferior officers, place the appointment of them in the president alone, so no Senate confirmation, or in the courts of law alone, no Senate confirmation, or in the heads of departments. And it's the heads of the department language that's at issue here. These administrative law judges were not appointed by the Securities and Exchange Commission itself, which collectively is the head of department. They were appointed by other lower officials in the Securities and Exchange Commission. And Lucia's challenge was that that everybody concedes that if these folks were inferior officers and not mere employees, that constitutional that appointment process would have been unconstitutional. And what you get to the Supreme Court, an opinion by Justice Kagan, writing for a 7-2 to majority, although Justice Breyer only concurs in part, but that's 6 votes in the majority, all joining Justice Kagan's majority opinion, says that because these administrative law judges exercise significant authority, and because they have a continuing position established by law, they are officers of the United States, not mere employees, and therefore they could only be appointed by the head of the department. Since the head of the department, the commission itself, did not appoint them, then it was a pretty easy case under governing Supreme Court precedent, 25 years ago in a case out of the Internal Revenue Service called FriTag, that these are inferior officers. They have to be appointed by the head of the department. They weren't, and therefore the appointment was illegal. And so Mr. Lucia wins the case. It's now going to have to go back. Now, what happened in the interim is the Securities and Exchange Commission, realizing their problem, has subsequently, on its own, appointed all of their administrative law judges. And so the court's holding was, you got to send it back to have a hearing before a duly appointed administrative law judge, and it can't be the same one who just decided the case after being unlawfully appointed. It has to be somebody else. So that's where we stand on the court decision itself. Let me touch on a couple of the disputes that come out with the concurring opinions and the dissent. Justice Thomas, joined by Justice Gorsuch, writes separately, concurring in full with Justice Kagan's opinion, but he would go further and say, look, instead of looking to the precedent in FriTag versus the Internal Revenue Service Commissioner, we ought to actually look at what the language of the Constitution meant at the time it was written, the public meaning that would have been evident to those that ratified the Constitution. And for Justice Thomas, that means that all federal civil officials who perform a statutory duty are officers in the United States and have to be appointed according to the Constitution's appointments clause. If they're inferior officers, that appointment can be vested in the president alone or a court or the head of a department. If they're principal officers, they have to be go through the Senate confirmation process. Justice Breyer was, I think, very troubled by the implications of that for the self on autopilot administrative state or the administrative bureaucracy that has grown up over the last 60 or 70 years, a bureaucracy that he's a big fan of. So he didn't want to reach the constitutional questions here at all. He says there was no authority for the Securities and Exchange Commission to delegate its appointment authority to other officials in the Securities and Exchange Commission, and therefore the delegation they made was itself a violation of the Administrative Procedures Act rather than of the Constitution. He does that, I think, because he wants to keep in place the entire infrastructure of administrative law interpretations being handled in administrative agencies themselves, because the administrative state just can't operate to the expansive extent that it currently does if we have to stick with the Constitution's reading of what the Appointments Clause requires. And so he's trying to find another way to protect the administrative bureaucracy, even though the SEC was going to lose in this particular case. Justice Sotomayor, joined by Justice Ginsburg, dissent. They would have distinguished the old Internal Revenue Service case, saying that was those were special law judges. These are administrative law judges. There's a difference. Justice Kagan, you know, I think in her majority opinion, quite correctly goes through point by point by point between the two cases and say they're virtually identical. If anything, the argument against the Securities and Exchange Commission here is even stronger than it was against the IRS commissioner in that old case. So I think what Justice Sotomayor and Ginsburg really want to do is overrule FriTag, and that would be an even bigger protection for the administrative bureaucracy, which they seem bent on doing. So that's the short. We've got a major constitutional issue here. It is part of, and I'll put it in kind of grand context a little bit, and then I'm going to pass it to Mark to talk about some of the things that could have been addressed by the court that weren't. And the bigger context is we're seeing now increasingly the court really cognizant of how its various doctrines over the years have bolstered a largely unconstitutional exercise of power in the unelected administrative agencies or in the unelected bureaucracy. And this decision this week is you know, yet another nail in the coffin of that freewheeling administrative law bureaucracy, just writing laws and enforcing the laws and adjudicating the laws that they've written and enforced, all by the same group of people, contrary to, you know, one of the most basic precepts of separation of powers that our Constitution embodies, from the great political philosophy of people like Montesquieu, It goes right back to the founding. So I think there's this renewed appreciation of the structural beauty and design of the Constitution, and how much over the last half century or more we've deviated from it, with now increasingly recognized pretty bad consequences. So this is I think this case is important as a component of that broader fight about just where is what is the legal authority for this huge administrative bureaucracy that has arisen over the last three quarters of a century. So that's the significance of the case from my perspective. And Mark can talk about some of the lingering issues that are undecided that are going to make it even more significant. Mark, back to you.
Well, thanks, John. That's a great summary. And let me thank the Federalist Society as well for the opportunity to participate in today's teleforum. It is much appreciated. There are several things that the court did not decide in Lucia. And interestingly, whether or not administrative law judges are principal officers or inferior officers is the first of these. The court in footnote 3 of the majority opinion notes that the government and Mr. Lucia both agreed that Administrative Law Judge Elliott was an inferior officer here, but the court did not decide that fact. It assumed it. And another plaintiff could challenge that, or if not, challenge that with regard to SEC ALJs, might find that there are other ALJs elsewhere in the administration or in a different context, different kind of case, where a strong claim might be made or put forward that an ALJ is a principal officer in some way. And as John's discussion suggested, if that were to happen, then those individuals would have to be appointed by the president and confirmed by the Senate and could not just be appointed by the SEC Commission. A second issue that the court did not decide is whether the statutory restrictions on removing administrative law judges are constitutional or not. The court, in footnote 1 of the majority opinion, notes that the Solicitor General sought a second question on that at the search stage of this case, but that question was not granted. Even so, the Solicitor General's merits brief again asked the court to address that question, and at oral argument, the government again pressed that point. Noel Francisco even told a Federalist Society lunch meeting here in D.C. last month that the answer to that question was part of why Lucia was a case that mattered so much. But again, the court did not address that. While deciding, while I agree with the Solicitor General that deciding that would have been important, the court said that no lower court had addressed that question, and that the Supreme Court usually relies on lower court analysis before jumping into contested questions like that. And we can come back to that, but it's true, but there are reasons why the court could have jumped into this now had it wanted to do so. The third issue that the court did not decide is what counts as significant authority. As John said, the test for whether someone is an officer boils down to whether they hold a continuing position. That's under the Germain precedent. And then whether or not they exercise significant authority, and that's under the Buckley v. Vallejo precedent. And you know, no one contests that the ALJs have a continuing position. So the question here is just whether they exercise significant authority. And some participants in the case wanted the court to use Lucia to elaborate on the test for exercising significant authority that had been laid out in Buckley v. Vallejo. Both Kagan's majority opinion and the Thomas concurrence, joined by Justice Gorsuch, acknowledge that the court has not provided much guidance on this question in the past. But since the majority and Kagan in particular regarded Lucia as a near carbon copy with the Freitag case, the Lucia majority saw no need to articulate further guidance here. Quote unquote, maybe one day, Kagan suggested, but that day is not this one. And again, as John suggested, the majority regarded this case as an a fortiori case that because the SEC ALJs had, if anything, a bit more last word capacity than the special judges at issue in Freitag, this case was already decided. And in fact, there's one sentence in the decision that essentially the entire decision boils down to, which is which means that Freitag decided the entire case. A fourth question that was not decided here is whether each of the items that the court discusses as being in common between the judges in Freitag and the judges, the SEC ALJs, whether each of those items is necessary for someone conducting adversarial hearings to count as an officer. So, for example, what if an officer can't take testimony, or excuse me, I shouldn't say officer, what if an administrative judge can't take testimony or can't discipline attorneys or can't make factual findings but does everything else? The court leaves us grasping in the dark as to whether that person is going to be deemed an officer of the United States or not in in a future case. The one thing the court does suggest is that final decision-making authority is not the sine qua non of officer status. Sotomayor puts that forward in her dissent as something that should be the test and a reason for finding the SEC ALJs not to be officers. But Kagan notes that Freitag explicitly rejected that theory, and there didn't seem any appetite on the part of the majority to revisit that question. A fifth question that the court left open is on the remedy front. The court sent Lucia back for a hearing before a different ALJ, but the court explicitly said that it does not hold that a new officer is required for every appointments clause violation on rehearing. And so had the problem been with the commission itself rather than one of the commission's ALJs, where no substitute decision maker would have been available in sending the case back, the court suggests that the rule of necessity would presumably have kicked in and that the same decision maker could have reheard the case. I'm not convinced that's true, and that's not the holding here. That's just dicta on the court's part. I think that's subject to challenge in the future under different circumstances. And the last point that I'll suggest that the court left open is that it did not decide whether the SEC's ratification attempt of the malappointed ALJs was sufficient. Mr. Lucia took issue with the SEC's attempt to ex post ratify the ALJs and make them constitutional going forward. But cagely, the court suggested that the commission itself could hear the case on remand and to avoid testing the validity of the ratification order in this case. So on remand, I guess we get to find out whether or not the SEC can take a hint. I did want to give a quick shout out to Jennifer Mascott, who was quoted widely. Professor Jennifer Mascott at George Mason at the Antonin Scalia Law School was quoted widely in the Thomas concurrence on the question of what the original public meaning of an officer of the United States was. And she's on NCLA's Board of Advisors, so I wanted to just compliment her for receiving so much attention in the concurrence, and then maybe throw it open to back to you, John. I think you talked about we could have some discussion back and forth.
Sure.
Before
and I'll add
questions.
My congratulations to Jennifer as well. It's wonderful confirmation of your scholarship when the Supreme Court, particularly the originalists on the Supreme Court, cited. So congratulations. There's one other lurking issue here, and I think it's actually the granddaddy issue. As we look at the implications of this case more broadly than just the Securities and Exchange Commission, there are over 1,300 ALJs over at the Social Security Administration. Justice Kagan's opinion also suggests that even beyond administrative law judges, we might have officer status to people who have been treated as employees who actually write regulations. The courts are deferring to those regulations that they've written, interpreting statutes. Oftentimes, they initiate enforcement proceedings based on the regulations they've written. So the regulation writers at the layer down below a commission or a head of an agency, I think all of those folks might well be deemed officers now under Justice Kagan's opinion, and certainly under Justice Thomas's concurrence opinion. And that then shows how broad the impact of this ruling might be. But it also forces us to confront, I think, the real granddaddy issue, which is why is this stuff going on in Article 2 of the branch of government? The executive is supposed to enforce the law. It's not supposed to write them. That's Congress's job. and it's not supposed to adjudicate the enforcement of those laws. That's Article III's job. And what we have going on here is the Securities and Exchange Commission is writing its own regulations, or worse, delegating that authority to employees in the Securities and Exchange Commission to write its regulations. Other people in the Securities and Exchange Commission are doing the executive job of enforcing those regulations, and then yet other people in the Securities and Exchange Commission, all in the same agency, and all technically, you know, owing their jobs to the same politically accountable head of the agency, they are adjudicating the enforcement of those laws that they wrote, the very definition of tyranny, according to Montesquieu, the executive, the legislative, and the judicial functions all combined in the same hands. And so, you know, one of the things that's appeared this week in the commentary on this case is how threatening it is to the independence of the administrative law judges, that we wanted those folks independent so they wouldn't be, you know, doing the bidding of their master, the Security and Exchange Commission, but they're in the same agency anyway. And if we need the independence, it's a requirement that the founders recognize, and they didn't, you know, Chinese wall off separate parts of a same executive agency to accomplish separation of powers principles. They walled it off even more broadly than that into separate branches of government. And if we really need independence for the adjudication phase of this stuff, as I believe we do, it ought to be over in Article III itself rather than somehow in Article II in under the executive authority. Otherwise, you're either undermining the chief executive's authority to control the executive branch or undermining the independence that's necessary for a fair adjudication of whether somebody has actually violated the law or not. And, you know, this is an issue that is growing increasingly large as the administrative state continues to expand, and yet it has largely been untouched for 75 years. And I think cases like this are going to force us to confront it. And then I'll say something about the
Can I jump in on
yeah,
those
sure.
two points before you get to your next one there, John?
Yeah.
First, on your point about some of the lower tier reg writers being inferior officers under this decision, I think you're absolutely right about that. And of course, that's a double-edged sword because on the one hand, there's a requirement in issuing regulations in many of these agencies that the regulation actually be issued, and sometimes it's by the head of the department or sometimes it's by an officer of the United States has to be the one who issues the regulation, and they haven't been really good about following that direction in some of the agencies. And in fact, I believe Pacific Legal Foundation is bringing litigation on that theory right now, that some agencies have been issuing regulations essentially under the wrong person's name. But the second, the reason it's a double-edged sword is because even though that problem could be solved by these folks being deemed officers now under Kagan's opinion, they weren't properly appointed under the appointments clause to have the officer status that they hold. So I think you could see a sort of another way of challenging some of the reg writers, just as the ALJs were challenged here. And then on your second point about independence, I couldn't agree more. That was actually the reason why the New Civil Liberties Alliance jumped into this case with an amicus brief, is precisely because we agree with the gist of what you were saying, John, that there's a real problem with bringing all of these things within an administrative agency. And part of what we focused on in our amicus brief was to show the court, and apparently Justice Breyer didn't read our brief or wasn't persuaded by it because he glosses right over this point, that the current ALJs at the SEC are not independent. They have to conform to the SEC's rules. They're not allowed to, for example, hear a constitutional challenge to one of the agency's rules. They have to assume that the rules are legitimate, that they're operating under. And there are all kinds of other bias that we go into based on how they're selected now and the fact that they don't have prior securities law expertise that they bring with them. Cameron Elliott, who was the administrative law judge in this case, for example, was brought over from the Social Security Administration where he had been an ALJ. He did not have prior securities law expertise. So the fact that I think the trade-off that sometimes people think we're making in the administrative state is that we are taking some constitutional shortcuts, but we're getting expertise in the bargain. But that it turns out that's not true. We're giving up the constitutional rights, and we're not even getting the expertise in most cases.
Well, and even if they were experts, sometimes I'm more nervous about experts deciding things than I am about a common sense ordinary citizen.
So well, particularly when they're not independent.
That's right, exactly. The other issue, and I want to elaborate on one of the ones that you talked about that was not addressed by the court, and that is the peekaboo issue, the free enterprise versus the public accounting board's case from a couple of years ago, that when you've got two layers of for cause removal, that the administrative law judge could only be removed for cause by the Securities Exchange Commission, which itself can be removed only for cause, you have really undermined the ability of the president to do his constitutional duty to take care that the laws be faithfully executed. There are a lot of reasons why somebody ought to be removed because they're simply not in line with the president's own policies. And the executive branch exists entirely under the authority of the president. Various lower officers are designated by statute, but their authority is derivative of the authority that the Constitution sets out under Article 2 to the president. And if you have these insulation efforts so that executive officials cannot be answerable to the president because of restrictions on their removal, the court has held that's unconstitutional. The double for cause removal was the holding of the peekaboo case. I love that acronym. Congress needs to pay more attention to how they put words together so we don't come up with these silly acronyms. But that's another ground why even now, if we get the appointment part fixed, why Noel Francisco in the Solicitor General's office is trying to get the court to say, look, and you've also got this peekaboo double removal for cause problem that makes them unconstitutional, even if the appointment problem is fixed on the front end. And if I were Mr. Lucia's lawyers, I would be arguing that on remand as well, because it's going back to the original design of the Constitution. These political branches are not supposed to be able to operate independently of the political authority from which their power derives. Their power to operate exists by virtue of Constitution's Article 2. And if the president doesn't have any authority over the line officers in the various agencies, they are operating as rogues, technically, as rogues without any political accountability. And that's not the constitutional system that Article 2 sets up. And I think the court has increasingly come to the realization that some of these mechanisms that were set up by statute just are really flout that basic separation of powers doctrine. And it's not just some archaic doctrine. That separation of powers doctrine is there to ensure that we don't get government acting tyrannically against its citizens. And the lack of political accountability that flows from some of these statutory schemes is ripe for that kind of abuse. And I think the courts, they're still playing at the margins, chipping away at the edge of the brick rather than going to the foundation of the problem. But we're getting closer and closer and closer to that foundation the more and more of these cases that come down.
And if you know of some potential cases, let John or me know, because our organizations like to bring these kinds of lawsuits.
Indeed. Well, with that, I think we can open up for questions if you want.
Yeah, absolutely. I'm ready to do that. I was just going to say, while people are thinking of their questions, that the other way to test this, in addition to Mr. Lucia bringing up the issue of double for-cause removal, would be for President Trump to just fire Administrative Judge Elliott this afternoon and test it that way.
And we could do a whole bunch of. Now, one of the common criticisms from the defenders of the bureaucracy is that there's just too much work. You would flood the courts. You can't possibly do it. Don't be so unpragmatic. Government's just too big, and all of the things they do, there's just too much. We've got to come up with these kind of mechanisms. And I would say, absolutely right. There's just too much that government's doing, and we can't do it by the constitutional way. But the resolution is not to ignore the Constitution. The resolution is for the government to quit doing so much. And I think our founders and their devotion to the notion of limited government understood that. And one of the reasons these constitutional checks are in place is to make sure we didn't get a government that got so big that it can't be controlled. And the refusal over the last three quarters of a century to enforce these core constitutional doctrines is what has led to this burgeoning bureaucracy that seems on autopilot, accountable to nobody, not the president, not to the citizens who vote for them. And that's just intolerable in a governmental system that is supposed to be rooted in the consent of the people.
Let's go to audience questions. In a moment, you'll hear a prompt indicating that the floor mode has been turned on. After that, to request the floor, enter star, then the pound key. When we get to your request, you'll hear a prompt, and then you may ask your question. We'll answer questions in the order in which they are received. Again, to ask a question, please enter star, then the pound key on your telephone keypad. Let's go to our first audience question.
Hi, good afternoon. Thank you for doing this very informative teleforum. This is Gregory Dolan from University of Baltimore. And I wanted to pick up on something that was, I think, mentioned throughout, how much is this case, especially for this Department of Justice and perhaps for some justice on this court, is a bit of a stalking horse. So when I read the DOJ, Solicitor General's briefs, and sort of the emphasis on the removal powers, so what kept coming back to my mind is this really is about not so much this case, but really about the CFPB that's coming down the pike. And taking the Department of Justice briefs, taking the Justice Kennedy's concurrence in Pereira when he suggests that perhaps we should reexamine Chevron, it does seem that there is this kind of bubbling up, not just on tinkering with appointments, but on this entire cross-examination of administrative state as a whole, both on the presidential power to control the entirety of administrative state, such as the removal proceedings, but also as well as the judiciary's power to control administrative state, to the extent we're going to re-examine Chevron and have the judges actually interpret the law. And so I was just wondering whether you've seen any of that, either going back to the oral arguments or in the opinion itself, or, you know, hints interspersed with other opinions released around the same time, as well as what the DOJ is doing in the cases coming up the pike.
I it's a terrific question and I think a spot on insight into what's going on. I mean, let's look at it from the perspective of the lawyers in the Solicitor General's office at the Department of Justice. You've got two models of what their representative legal duty is. Is their duty to represent the agency to push its claims of power based on any plausible argument derived from prior precedent that it can? Or is its duty to faithfully to implement the president's duty to faithfully execute the laws, which includes not taking stands that they themselves think are beyond the constitutional authority, even if there had been prior court decisions saying that step might have been okay. And most solicitor generals in the past have taken the former view that the agency itself is its client, and of course the agency wants more power, they want more deference to their decisions, they want less oversight, they want less political accountability. The current SG, I think to his great credit, is taking the latter stance, that our duty is to the Constitution. We take the same oath, the president takes the same oath, that the judges take, and that is to faithfully execute the law. That includes the law of the Constitution. And if we've added a bunch of unconstitutional barnacles to the ship of state over decades of inattention to those constitutional constraints, our job is to try and remove those barnacles and get back to what the Constitution actually requires and start raising those questions again, rather than just like the frog who boils himself in slow boiling water, you know, gradually getting to the point where our administrative state is simply unrecognizable as a matter of constitutional authority. And so I do think cases like this are, and not a stalking horse, I think they're more you know, chipping away at some of those barnacles to get back to the true form, separation of powers form of the Constitution. And the implications will play out in lots of other areas as well. But I think that's a good thing. And quite frankly, I think the Solicitor General's office doing that kind of thing is long overdue.
Yeah, I wouldn't say stalking horse. I would say that the administrative state is starting to collapse of its own weight in some respect. And, you know, I applaud the Solicitor General for, and John, I can't remember if you mentioned this or not, but the government switched sides in this case, right? At the D.C. Circuit below, the government was on the other side of the case, arguing that these ALJs were not officers, that they were mere employees. And so the fact that the Solicitor General was willing to switch sides on this, I think, is very much to his credit. That said, as John knows, you know, I had a cert petition in front of the Supreme Court that was denied about this time last year in a case called Gordon v. CFPB, in which John's outfit had filed an amicus brief in support of the cert petition, where we were challenging the Consumer Financial Protection Bureau director's ability to bring cases, to bring enforcement actions at a point in time when he had not been properly appointed. And the court had already held that he had not been properly appointed, but it denied cert on the question of whether he could, you know, bring lawsuits at a point in time when he was not properly properly installed. And so Noel Francisco was not in place yet. This was under then acting Solicitor General Wall. So I can't. So maybe the outcome would have been different, at least in terms of the SG's position on the case, if Noel had been there. But there have been, I guess my point to the question is, there have been other opportunities for the court to chip away at the administrative state that it has taken a pass on. And so I don't think that, and I think that's unfortunate. I think that there are many other things that need to be corrected. And I hope that this is a sign of things to come, and that the denial of cert in the Gordon case last year proves to be the exception to the rule.
Let's go to our next audience question.
Hi, this is Bob Fitzpatrick in D.C. Great presentation. I represent real people. I'm not a law professor. I don't write amicus briefs. I represent people either one way or the other before ALJs. So I have two questions. I assume these issues are jurisdictional. So my concern is, typically jurisdiction can be raised at any time. So I like my ALJ, let's say. I win my case before my ALJ. My opponent doesn't raise these issues at the front end, but after I win, at the back end, it being jurisdiction, can they raise it? So that's one concern, is timing. Second question is, I assume if I am before an ALJ at the state level, which I oftentimes am, or at the District of Columbia level, where there's a whole different kettle of fish in terms of what constitutional provisions apply, do I have to look? I assume I do not look necessarily to the federal constitution, but I look to the Ohio, Virginia, whatever jurisdiction I may be in, to its constitution to make these same arguments. Those are my two questions.
So with regard to the first question, subject matter jurisdiction is something that you could bring up later, but personal jurisdiction is waivable. So that's not something that you can complain about at the back end.
And let me add to that. I think Justice Kagan's opinion in fashioning the remedy says if you had raised the appointment issue when you were before the ALJ, you've waived it and won't be able to raise it. So they're not going to reopen, you know, 50 years or 30 years worth of ALJ decisions as a result of the ruling in Lucia this week.
Right. But in terms of whether you can raise some of these same sorts of objections at the state and local level, I think the answer is absolutely. It may not. There may not be, U.S. constitutional objections at the state or local level. In fact, chances are there won't be, at least not of this variety, but there there could well be parallel provisions in state constitutions that would allow similar challenges to be made.
But it would depend on what's in the state constitution. Some states have stricter separation of powers issues in place in their state constitution. Some have looser ones. Some have appointments clauses similar to the federal government's. Others don't, and it's much more freewheeling. And so it would really be state by state specific on whether this kind of an argument would have any traction in a state ALJ proceeding.
We have one more caller in the queue. Let's go to that caller.
Hey, gentlemen, this is Ken Fowler. I'm in New York. Thank you for the presentation. This is very interesting. I have a two-part question. First is whether you think that there are any obvious examples of other ALJs in other departments that will or won't be impacted by the logic and reasoning of this decision. I think the CFPB, the FTC, International Trade Commission, CFTC, and possibly a few more have ALJs, all with varying regulations. And so it'll be interesting to see how that plays out, and what are your thoughts there? And then two, non-ALJs who might be affected. Obviously, now we've had STJs and ALJs where the courts decided they are officers, but you mentioned reg writers, and I'm wondering if there might be other individuals who are also going to be subject to challenges here.
Go ahead, John. Yeah, how about I answer about the judges and you answer about the reg writers?
Oh, sure. Go ahead.
Okay. What I was going to say is that the one distinction between ALJs, that John mentioned that there are something like 1,300 ALJs over at the Social Security Administration. One difference between among ALJs is that ones at the Social Security Administration and the Veterans Administration, for example, are adjudicating benefits, different kinds of governmental benefits that people are supposed, you know, have a statutory I'm trying to avoid the word entitlement, but under certain statutory parameters, they can get those benefits. That's very different from what the ALJs are doing at the SEC or some of the other agencies you mentioned, where you're really talking about individuals' rights, the right to in Mr. Lucia's case, to continue to practice his profession as a stockbroker of some kind or another. My initial take would be that this decision will not have as much of an impact on ALJs in the benefits context of Social Security or Veterans Affairs, which is, the lion's share, the vast majority of. If there's 1,300 there's something like 150 ALJs everywhere else combined. But I do think that those folks who like the SEC ALJs are dealing with these rights adjudication questions will very much be impacted by this decision.
And, you know, I think the kind of principle you can tease out of Justice Kagan's opinion on this is in the conduct of exercising executive enforcement authority, have they then taken the next step and start adjudicating that prosecution? And if that's the case, not only should that person be an officer appointed according to the Appointments Clause, but that person, by logic, may well have to be in Article 3 rather than in Article 2. That's not the case on the benefit side, because we are still implementing or enforcing the law in deciding who meets the eligibility criteria. The challenge to that enforcement decision can be brought then in a court where you have the Article 3 adjudication of it. We're just doing some preliminary. It's not really an adjudication. It's a determination by the executive on how to enforce or apply the benefit statute here. And I think that's an important difference in the SEC context. This person was charged with violating an SEC regulation. The regulation itself, assuming it was properly derived from an authority of statute, is a exercise of executive power. But then the ALJ is deciding whether that enforcement action, whether the person should be convicted or charged under that enforcement action or not. So in the response to the prosecution, the executive function, have you now crossed the line into a judicial function? And if you have, I would take those people out and put them over in Article 3 themselves and say, oh, there may be too many. Well, if there are too many, just, reduce the budget for the agency and increase the budget for the court and add a bunch of magistrate judges to do the function, the judicial function that these ALJs are doing.
There's only five ALJs at the SEC. It would only take five judges being added to the federal judiciary to solve this constitutional problem. I think we should do it.
Again, to ask a question, please enter star, then the pound key on your telephone keypad.
To one of the points that John made about the executive versus the judicial function happening here, one of the things that jumped out at me in Sotomayor's dissent was that she talked about officers as being people who bind the rights of others. And I said, bind the rights of others, that's not something that Article 2, that Article 2 officials are supposed to be able to do. Binding the rights of others is something that only Congress can do or the Article 3 courts can do. So I thought that was a fascinating offering from her, that should be the distinction of what makes an officer of the United States.
And since Mark gave a victory lap to Jennifer on his board, I'm going to take a victory lap on behalf of our own Center for Constitutional Jurisprudence here, because we started more than a decade ago in our briefing to the Supreme Court raising a number of these administrative law issues, the pushback against the administrative state, the deference doctrines that the court had developed over years that effectively undermine not just the legislative authority of Article I's Congress, but the judicial authority of the Article III courts, and was pushing more and more of these decision-making for lawmaking, for executing, and for judging, all to the administrative agencies. And we started pressing back against that. There are real problems with these deference doctrines and these real problems with these appointments authorities. And I think when some of the justices started writing concurring opinions, raising those issues, all of a sudden everybody in town is now looking and realizing how far we've become from the real structure of the Constitution and starting to question the validity of all those things. I think why we now are seeing so many of these cases coming forward. Lawyers at all of the major firms, in-house counsel at all the major industries are now adding these counts to their complaints, challenging adjudicative rulings against them in the various agencies, and they're starting to get some traction. And it's a very encouraging sign that it is possible, even though we've gotten far removed from the Constitution, that there's a path back.
Amen.
We have two questions in the queue, so let's go to that next caller.
Hi, my name is Megan Murphy. I'm a law student. Thank you for taking my question. I'm wondering if, to the extent that you're aware of it, do you have any thoughts in light of yesterday's decision about the Appointments Clause case before the bankruptcy judge in Puerto Rico regarding the establishment of the supervisory board there?
I'm not familiar with that case, so I can't comment on that one.
Yeah, I'm not either. Although the bankruptcy judges, it's always been a question in my mind whether the Constitution's appointments authority is being properly implemented there as well. But I don't know the particular case enough to be able to comment.
Let's go to our next question.
The Merit Systems Protection Board has what they call AJs, or administrative judges. They don't have some of the protections of administrative law judges and other departments. And these AJs at the MSPB deal with a lot of things, some of which actually deal with the rights of an individual. For example, if I'm a federal civilian employee and I allegedly commit a prohibited personnel practice, the Office of Special Counsel
can bring a proceeding in the MSPB, which can result in my loss of federal civilian employment and disqualification from future employment. I'm wondering how this case would apply to the AJs of the Merit Systems Protection Board.
Well, I think it would apply, and I think you could do Justice Kagan's analysis and go side by side with what the authority of the AJs and the MSPB are, and compare it to FriTag and now to the SEC, and you find that there's a pretty strong overlap. In fact, this is a huge issue. People may recall that one of the early challenges to President Obama's DACA program was down in Texas, and the court ruled that the president acted illegally because the statute says the line officers in the immigration services shall put into removal proceedings anybody who they come across who's here illegally. That was the initial tentative ruling in the case, and then somebody pointed out, well, these are government employees. Their whole action, their whole challenge needs to be before the Merit Systems Protection Board. And so they punted a major judicial case and issue over to an executive agency that is supposed to be enforcing, not adjudicating. And so not just the FriTag and now Lucia problem, but I think the broader Article 2 versus Article 3 problem that we've been discussing is at issue in that context.
Thank you.
Again, to ask a question, please enter star, then the pound key on your telephone keypad. Let's go to the next caller.
Hi, John. This is Bill Hodes, formerly from Indiana, now Florida, from 1996 days. I just wanted to follow up on the very last couple of comments about how the administrative state problem can blend over into a clash between Article 2 and Article 3, which I agree with completely. But there's one, a comment was made that one way of getting out of some of these problems is to turn some of the ALJs, if there are only five of them, into magistrate judges. And I just wanted to remind that although that would certainly solve the appointments clause problem, it wouldn't solve all of the other separation of powers, because magistrates are not Article III judges. They don't have life tenure and so on. So there wouldn't be an appointments clause problem with them, but you would have, they're housed in the judicial branch, but they are judicial officers, but they are definitely not Article III judges. And so there would have to be some tinkering with, you know, how somebody at the margins of Article II interacts with somebody at the margins of Article III.
John and I were talking about this issue a little bit before the call, and one of the things I said was, imagine what a difference it would make if litigants had to agree to appear in front of an ALJ, like you have to agree to appear in front of a magistrate judge in federal district court. I mean, the incentives for ALJs to actually deal fairly with litigants would be so much different in that context than what their current incentives are, where, you know, they report to the SEC commissioners, their salaries are determined by the SEC. I mean, there are all these factors that contribute to the lack of independence that ALJs have that would be vastly improved by moving them from Article 2 to Article 3. It doesn't solve everything, but it would be vastly improved. And for one thing, the federal rules of evidence would apply, which they don't apply in ALJ proceedings. Due process would apply. The discovery rules would be better. You could have a jury under many circumstances. I mean, one of the things that I really coughed at in reading Kagan's majority opinion is she says at one point that SEC ALJs have, quote unquote, all the tools necessary to conduct a fair trial. No, they don't. That's just not true. The kind of trials that are conducted by ALJs are vastly different from what's done by a federal magistrate judge or certainly by a federal district court judge.
No, yeah, I agree with those, but I think there still is a gap there, because the point you make about you have to agree to at least hear the full boat of your litigation before an ALJ, I'm sorry, before a federal magistrate. But the alternative, if you don't agree, is you go to an Article III judge. In an agency, there sort of is no other place to go, unless you're proposing to take all of these adjudications and put them as a default before Article III judges.
Precisely.
Which I don't think that's realistic, because say what you want about the mission creep of the or mission domination of the administrative state since 1930s and 40s, or since Wilson, but it would be just insanely costly to have hundreds and hundreds of extra Article III judges. I think that's
it's only five. There's only
realistic.
Five SEC ALJs.
Right, but you're saying you would make them life ten. You would say no more ALJs. Everybody goes to federal district court.
That would be one option. That would be the constitutional option, I think.
Yeah.
I don't think this would solve the problem, but it would be better. I think it would be an improvement over the status quo to say, well, the agency can propose to proceed in front of the ALJ, but if the defendant prefers to be in federal district court, then the defendant can opt for that.
Yeah, then that would solve my problem.
Very good. Well, I think we're nearly at the end of our time. I want to again thank the Federal Society for hosting this and all of those of you that joined us on this call. Federal Society, you got any closing remarks?
Our next regularly scheduled telephone conference call is scheduled for Wednesday at 12 noon, and that will be a courthouse steps decision for Gill versus Whitford. Keep an eye out for upcoming emails. We expect a bunch of Supreme Court decisions on Monday and probably Tuesday of next week, so we'll be announcing a lot of teleforum calls. You're welcome. On behalf of the Federalist Society, I want to thank our experts for the benefit of their valuable time and expertise today. Would either of you like to make closing remarks?
I just want to reiterate the importance, although still chipping away at the edges, the importance of raising these fundamental constitutional separation of powers questions for the ultimate enhancement of liberty for all of us. And I applaud the court and a pretty significantly overwhelming majority of the court that is now appreciating the importance of these kind of issues.
Well, thank you both for joining us. We welcome listener feedback by email at info@fedsoc.org. Thank you all for joining us. We are adjourned.
Thank you for listening. We hope you enjoyed this Practice Group podcast. For materials related to this podcast and other Federalist Society multimedia, please visit the Federalist Society's website at fedsoc.org/multimedia.